The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we're sitting here in Costa Mesa. We had a great dinner with clients a couple of nights ago, and there were some excellent questions that came up. I think of some of the questions referring to just what's happened to gold over the last 3 weeks. And so it'd be nice if we could, for the listeners who cannot be to the Costa Mesa Conference or the Seattle Conference, to hear what your responses are right now on the gold market. What's changed?
You know, there's a lot of things. When you look at the perspective of where the U.S. was 40, 50, 60 years ago, move forward from the Bretton Woods Agreement, and the U.S. at the time was 50% of world industry, and we had 90% of the world's gold reserves. We had well over 22,000 tons. That's been reduced to 8,000 tons. And, of course, that was why Nixon closed the gold window. That's why we got very concerned about, as the whole world had growing concerns with the stability of the U.S. dollar. It was for good reason that they were scrambling and getting as much of those ounces or tons as they could when they were. There was a focus then on the physical metals. And I think we're moving back into a period of time where, just like the early 1970s, there will be again a focus on the physical metals. And this is in stark contrast to what we've had over the last, let's call it 1 month, where the dominant theme has had little to do with the physical metals. It's had everything to do with the paper.
Well, and when you say dominant theme, you're talking about the pricing of gold, not necessarily the demand for gold.
The pricing of gold has been impacted by the futures market, and that is in stark contrast to what we've seen developing in the physical market. So, you know, I think, again, when you look back at world gold reserves being 90% in the United States, you know, circa 1944, to significantly less than that today, and there being a major departure from the world central banks owning gold, that is, Western central banks owning gold, and a move towards gold, not again from the European or U.S. central banks, but the developing nations of the world, which have a much smaller percentage allocation to gold at present and are increasing those allocations significantly. We're seeing a very similar, a reminiscent, if you will, scramble towards the physicals, not unlike the 70s. And I think, frankly, a lot of what is behind that is the fiscal issues and the monetary issues, which were also concerning in the 1970s.
Well, and you know, I think it's interesting that you're tying this in with the late 60s, early 1970s, because in a strange way, David, gold was being manipulated. The price, the paper price of gold was being held flat at, you know, $35 an ounce. That's an interesting concept, because actually the outflows or the deliveries of gold were setting all-time records at that time. They ultimately had to break that artificial pricing by going off the gold standard. And then, of course, the rest is history. $35 gold, that's a long ways behind us.
Well, but we are seeing massive amounts of physical metals, whether it's China and Hong Kong this last year bringing in 835 tons. And then fast forward to the Shanghai Exchange, just in the first few months of 2013, 1,000 tons of physical gold demanded off of the Shanghai Exchange. And as we noted a few weeks ago, they actually ran out of gold and were taking special deliveries out of London and Zurich in order to meet demand. And again, literally, it was the first time, as far as I'm aware, that the Shanghai Exchange had to put basically a delayed delivery in motion because demand had outstripped supply, and in that context had to resupply themselves significantly.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, Dave. It's not just the tonnage of gold that we're talking about, but even jewelry demand and retail demand. Shanghai's reporting an 108% increase this year over last year, and it was very brisk last year.
And it's no different in India. 800 metric tons last year, and we're seeing the same kinds of demand metrics for this year as well. In the last 4 months, I mean, this is the early part of 2013, we're seeing on average the daily allocations for gold out of London between 15 and 20 tons, 15 and 20 tons per day. So, I mean, again, there's a very different story being told when you compare and contrast the paper market, that, again, is the futures contract market, versus the physical market?
Well, and just bring it home, Dave. I mean, you would think that April would have been a discouraging month for gold buyers and that quite a few people would have said, it's going down. They tell me it's a bear market. I'm going to go ahead and sell. But the U.S. Mint, just in April, they sold 209,500 U.S. American Eagles. That's 10 times more than what they sold last year. And it exceeds every April since 2010. 2010, 11, and 12 combined. So people are buying physical metals with both hands. This really does remind you of 1968 to 1971.
And I think, you know, when we reflect on this, we've certainly entertained the question, do we expect to see gold go up in our lifetime? Now, fast forward and let's say that you're 70 years old. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you're 75 or 80 years old. And asking the same question, will I see gold go up again in my lifetime? I think the answer is emphatically yes. What we're on the cusp of is a major divorce from the pricing of metals in the paper contract world and the real price of the metals in the physical market. And I think what everyone should assume is that there will be heretofore premiums to be paid for any physical product.
And that was an amazing thing, Dave. A couple of days ago, we were looking at the premiums on kilo bars coming out of Dubai. And kilo, of course, is the cheapest way you can go, you know, kilos or 100-ounce bars or 400-ounce bars. That's usually the big money, just putting something into storage. And, you know, the 50-cent premium on kilos is sort of standard in Dubai. The kilo bars were selling at a $6 to $9 premium before any commission was put on top. I mean, that's the premium on the bar from the wholesaler.
That's very telling because the kilo bar is just, frankly, a bar. I mean, there's nothing particularly interesting about
it. You don't barter with it. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. And it's actually in the smaller items where you're seeing the premiums really move higher. I mean, smaller items down to your silver, dimes, quarters, and 50-cent pieces,
right,
where we've seen premiums as high as 15-16%, currently hovering between 10-12% over just the raw silver content. And these are products that generally have zero premium. So again, when you're dealing with the basic economics 101, supply and demand, what you're seeing is demand outstripping supply. And it's not indicated by the price because the price is being ramrodded or bullied by that paper contract world. Can that happen over and over again? Can that be a state of affairs which continues? Again, this is where I begin to guess that there is a dichotomy, a stark contrast between the two markets, one which trades at one price and the other which trades at a dramatically different price based on the physical metals and premiums which apply to it. So this is a very interesting point in time. It's what in the world of gold, in the world of paper contracts, you could call backwardation, where, you know, you have the front month or the gold which is easiest to take delivery of trading at a premium over the future months. But you can take that concept of backwardation and assume that we're moving towards a more or less permanent state of affairs with the physical markets being priced differently, being treated differently in the open market because people want the real thing. People want the real thing and not just a contract which says at some future date you may have it at a certain price.
Well, I know, David, you're a student of history, and you know, if we were to just go back in a time machine and say, when has this happened before? Okay, we saw it with the Greeks back in the BC period of time with silver when the Greek government was debasing their currency. We definitely saw it in the Roman period of time. You know, Julius Caesar paid all of his troops in real gold, and somehow all the troops from the other generals wanted to work for Julius Caesar. But you go a couple of hundred, well, 300 years after the birth of Christ, and you get to a period of time where the outlying Roman areas were accumulating gold because they saw the debasement of currency. I was reading in Winston Churchill's History of English Speaking People, and he said, in the early 20th century, they found a huge hoard of gold in England, which at that time was a Roman protectorate. And they were using Roman coins, but they saw the debasement. They started accumulating physical gold, non-dependent on what the money was actually doing. I think we've seen this throughout history, where you have a certain sect of the populace realize that there's something wrong. They start accumulating. And, you know, it's due to the debasement of currencies of various governments in the past.
And again, you talk about the journey from Caesar to Diocletian. And in by the time you get to the 3rd century AD, you're dealing with a denarius, which at one time had close to 100% of its content in silver, to, you know, again, right around the turn of that century, 300, virtually no silver at all. Mm. And it was in rapid decline those last 50 years. That last 50-year period, from 250 to 300, you had more of a change in terms of the emperors, the number of emperors in that 50-year period, than at any other time frame in Roman history.
So you see social upheaval along with inflationary pressures.
Exactly. People are clamoring for an explanation. They're not happy. They're willing to blame people at the top. They're willing to, frankly, blame just about anyone. And it's interesting that by 301, you've got Diocletian putting in place price controls and assuming that he can step in and control the market. Now, I'm not saying that Diocletian is the modern-day Ben Bernanke or Ben Bernanke is the modern-day Diocletian, because Diocletian then went on to instigate in 303 one of the greatest slaughters of Christians on the planet. And I certainly don't think that that's in any way related to Ben, but what you do see is a massive devaluation in process. You do see a tremendous amount of political and social upheaval, and you do see a tremendous amount of political turmoil where, again, the emperor seat is changing over and over and over and over again, and it is very common for politicians ultimately to scapegoat and point a finger. And in 303, that's exactly what Diocletian did, instituting what we know as one of the great persecutions of Christians. That was the 3rd century. If you fast forward, you find the same sort of social disruption, the same sort of blame casting, if you will. And then this was an actual literal witch hunt. They were searching for the cause. This was Britain, circa the 1550s to 1640s, a good 70, 80, 90 year period where the years of highest inflation translated into the greatest number of witch trials. I mean, and literally there was this social need for purging, if you will, looking for the evil spirits, trying to figure out what is the cause of pain and suffering. It certainly could not be the fact that during that period of time, the currency was being destroyed. It was being destroyed, but that's beside the point. I mean, this goes back to John Maynard Keynes and his famous quote, dealing with inflation, when he says, by a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. And by this method, they not only confiscate arbitrarily, and while the process impoverishes many, it actually enriches some. Now, that certainly, Kevin, I think we can see that today.
Oh, we see the bubbles all over the place.
Yeah, asset price inflation in the context of a currency devaluation. Now, he goes on to say it actually enriches some. Those to whom the system brings windfalls become profiteers, who are the object of the hatred. The process of wealth getting degenerates into a gamble, in a lottery. Again, sounds very reminiscent of what we have today. And then, you know, you've got John Maynard Keynes sort of anticipating what we have seen today, but also reflecting on history, some of what we're talking about in relation to the 3rd century and there in the 16th century. Lenin was certainly right, he says. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. And I think that's a key point that Keynes is making. We're talking about an erosion of society, not just an erosion of currency and purchasing power. The process engages, he goes on to say, all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one in a million is able to diagnose. That problem of diagnosis is why the Christians were blamed in the 3rd century, why there was witch hunts in the 1550s, 1640s, 1650s, 1660s. And then you fast forward to the French Revolution, and this is a story that Andrew Dixon White tells very well in Fiat Money, Inflation in France. It's an absolute must read. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's only about a 120-page commitment. So it's something that you should not only have on your library, but have well read.
It's a classic.
It is a classic. Yeah. But what he looks at is this period of 1789, when the French Revolution was beginning. And also, at the same time, you've got the currency devaluation in play. A massive inflation, in fact, one that tears at the fabric of French society. By the time you get to 1793, just a few years later, 1793 is literally when the heads begin to roll.
That's when the guillotine was definitely in function.
17,000 heads of nobles were rolling.
The slaughter of the nobles.
And so again, you go from debasing a currency to debasing society, and you can blame the Christians, you can blame the witches, you can blame the nobility, you can even fast forward to a more modern period, 1919 to 1924.
Right.
You know, the Germans dealing with the Versailles War reparations and the forced devaluation of the currency. Haverstein was doing what he thought made the most sense at the time, which was if you need more money, just print more money. And again, I mean, if there is anything that sounds very, very familiar today, well, are we talking about Mario Draghi? Are we talking about Caruda? Are we talking about Ben Bernanke? Are we talking about Mark Carney at the Bank of England? I mean, all of these guys are basically pulling a Haverstein move in saying, we need more money. We need more liquidity. That's fine. Just print it. And, you know, the problem was, obviously, there was a lot packed into that period, 1919 to 1924, a very intense period post-war where you had a people who were humiliated once, but were in the process of a second humiliation, a second intense humiliation, and they lost their currency. The mark was destroyed. Fortunes were overturned. And what do you have in that context? Where you had great inflation, both in Austria and in Germany, you also had a tremendous amount of blame, a tremendous amount of, again, the equivalent of a witch hunt. Who has done this? Who is responsible? And the rise of anti-Semitism, the new party, the National Socialist Party, 1923 was basically the genesis of the party. The worst part of the hyperinflation between 1923 and 1924. And within 10 years, you've got Hitler rising to power, someone who is going to redignify a people who has been utterly taken advantage of, that's the way they felt at the time, and abused and humiliated, and he was going to restore some sort of national pride. But the question was, who was to blame? It was the Christians in the 3rd century. It was the witches in the 16th century. It was the nobles in the 18th century in France. It was the Jews in the 19th century. Will it be the 1% today? Because the argument we would make, and make strongly, is that we're in a similar period of currency devaluation. The problem is, this time we're not talking about a particular country. We're not talking about a particular set of leaders. We're talking about a nearly universal.
It's the whole world. Dave, the Swiss franc was the last currency that had a gold-backed currency to it, and they pegged to the euro a few years ago. So we're in a fiat-complete world at this point.
And it's fascinating to see what happened. When the Swiss did, in fact, have what we would call a de facto devaluation, pegging to the euro, their stock market took off. By take off, I mean up well over 50% from when they decided to do that.
So the S&P 500 going up 30% in the last couple of years is nothing compared to the Swiss, but it's all based on just printed currency. These are not real moves.
Well, and see, this is the same thing that we have in the Nikkei today. You've got Abenomics and this new leadership, political leadership and leadership at the Bank of Japan, which is paving the way towards greater wealth. Is that the real question? Is that what's being created here? Is new wealth? Or are we talking about creating a crisis of confidence, one which has unintended consequences? And I think for a student of history to see that there's more at stake than just the decline and devaluation of a currency, you're really talking about tearing at the fabric of society.
David, something we were looking at just recently was the rapid increase of inflation when it actually hits. When it turns into high inflation and then ultimately hyperinflation, it usually starts in relatively calm single-digit numbers. In other words, Germany in the 1920s. I mean, they were running at a 3 to 6% inflation rate before it went into the, well, trillions by the time it was done. But if you look at the chart, it just goes vertical. It's like a hockey stick. So are we talking right now about possibly having a hyperinflationary moment rather than a steady increase of inflation?
I think it's certainly reasonable to assume that the pieces of the puzzle are in place for just such an event to occur. And this is what is challenging. In the past, we've had various places that you could go as a safe harbor. As you mentioned, the Swiss franc. The Swiss franc was a quote-unquote hard currency. Where are the hard currency nations today? I mean, at best, you can say, well, what about the Australian dollar? Because surely they have a vast natural resources backing their currency and their economy. I mean, you can make those kinds of arguments, but there is nothing technically backing the Australian dollar.
Right. Just because there's resources in the country doesn't mean they're not printing money.
No, and that's correct. They may be printing less than we are today, but that's what's so deceptive. In a world of floating currencies, all you have is a relative gauge, and it literally is like taking vitals in a hospital. If you're in a hospital, something has gone wrong. You may be in better shape than the man or the woman in the sick bed next to you, but the fact that you're in the hospital to begin with, it should be no comfort that right. you're doing slightly better than someone else. You need to get to the point where you're not in that position at all.
Well, and you know, David, I think we should go back and look at the peak on gold, okay, going back to August of 2011 and say, all right, what has changed since then that would cause gold to go down? Have we decreased our debt? Have we stopped printing money? Have we stopped quantitative easing? Has the U.S. credit rating actually risen? It's just the opposite, Dave. In August of 2011, the U.S. credit rating, which was the bastion of safety, went from AAA to AA+. Okay? We've created another $2 trillion on the already substantial debt that we have in that time. We have quantitative easing right now at $85 billion a month minimum. And, you know, they may talk about tightening it up every once in a while, but it's only talk. We always see the numbers coming out higher. So you have more and more money being printed. You have more and more debt. Yet the paper markets, and I feel for our clients who are looking at this, you know, our retired clients have already been absolutely beaten up in the interest markets with repressive interest rates. Yet you've got Mario Draghi over in Europe saying, you know, everybody needs to have an open mind towards negative deposit rates.
In other words, charging you for keeping money at the bank, you know, or certainly banks having to pay interest on what's held at deposit at a central bank, you know, excess reserves. They're trying to do everything that they can, Kevin, to create a recovery, and it's coming very hard. They have not been able to do that thus far. We don't see it in Europe. We don't see it in the United States. We don't see it in China. And here's the problem. Where is the engine of growth? To some degree, you've got some growth in the developing countries.
Right.
But again, if you look at how the flow of funds and the flow of capital occurs, there is still too much interconnectedness between mm-hmm. East and West, between the developed and the developing worlds. And when you're dealing with a crisis of confidence or a crisis in credit in the developed world, there are, there always has been, there always will be consequences into the developing world as well.
One of our very valued client couples a couple of nights ago at dinner brought up a great point that they feel like they've been stolen from. They had saved and saved and saved with the thought that they could earn interest. That interest not only has been taken away, but the value of their currency, even if they sit at 0%, is devaluing. But this is a second element of it, though. Not only had they been stolen from on the interest rates and the value of the currency, but right now, at least temporarily in the paper markets in gold, they feel like the only bastion of safety that they had is now losing money as well. Even though a lot of people are buying physical gold, gold temporarily right now is down. For the retired person who's not earning interest, who doesn't have safety in currency, now they're starting to wonder if they even have safety in gold. How would you respond?
Well, I think the reality that they're dealing with is not some sort of subjective reality. It is the reality, big R reality. We are talking about a world in which there is inflation.
Right.
I mean, I practically got into an argument with Trish Regan on Bloomberg the other day because she said, where is inflation? You show me where there's inflation, I don't think it exists. Mm. What are you talking about? You say inflation's everywhere. The statistics don't say it's there at all. It's the burden of proof is on you to prove that there's any inflation. And I, of course, tried to keep my cool, but yes, it's everywhere. The only places you don't see it, as I mentioned, were in candy bars and cereal boxes where the size of both are shrinking and they're charging the same. So the same prices as they were before. There is inflation and that is a form of theft. So, you know, acknowledging that there is some sort of a grand heist, that's important. Understand that your underlying sense of frustration is normal. You should be feeling that way. And I think where you have to be careful is who you blame. And that's the point. Is that in centuries past, it's been easy to find a scapegoat and blame someone who's not actually responsible. Meanwhile, there are parties responsible. And this is where the grand experiment with interest rates is part and parcel to the money printing and the inflation that we're seeing directly from the Fed. Because the Fed is setting those interest rates at a ridiculously low level. So you have that repression of interest rates, which is the second form of theft.
Right.
Income that should be going to savers is not going to savers. It's going to augment and subsidize the national debt. Your income is going to the government. What should have been your income on your savings is going. Yet one more form of monetary redirection from you to them.
With artificial low interest rates.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, you know, this is a period of time where everything is screaming bullish in terms of the fundamentals for gold. Technicals are screaming bearish. And the question is, which do you put more stock in? The fact that the world is going broke rapidly, not just sort of the old version of Mark Twain, how did you go broke slowly and then all at once? We're already in the all at once stage.
Right.
We're dealing with desperate measures by central banks all over the world trying to coordinate efforts and make sure that they don't lose control. I mean, and this is where I think when you are dealing with desperate measures, you have to keep a cool head. Absolutely have to keep a cool head. And don't be surprised. If they will steal from you via inflation, if they will steal from you via interest rate or financial repression, they certainly will do everything that they can to discourage you from owning gold, the only alternative to the banking system and the dollar-based system that we have today, the world monetary system. So, yes, the gloves are off. There is a fight for survival. Status of all persuasion would like for you to throw in the towel and to make sure that you leave with the tail between your legs, selling the last few ounces that you may have, admitting defeat and their victory.
Well, David, what you were talking about, fundamentally, it's screaming a bull market in gold. Yes, I mean, with the amount of sales in physical gold we talked about, that it's screaming a bull market. But until the gold runs out, the paper guys seem to be winning. And that's what you're talking about on technical charting. The technicians watch charts. They say, oops, this is a bull. Oops, this is a bear. And they look at it that way. Fundamentals, though, we just now talked about history. You could have looked at technical charts any time during the Roman Empire, during this period of time, 300 AD. You could have looked in England in the 1600s, in France, right before the hyperinflation there. You could have looked at the charts in Germany. That's what I was saying. You look at the chart, and technically, it didn't look like there was going to be hyperinflation, and then there was a collapse. So the chartists are right, let's say 90% of the time. And then there's that 10% complete revaluation of things where you go back to fundamentals. If you can actually survive until the fundamentals kick back in and you're right on the fundamentals, that's where wealth is transferred.
Well, and let me just qualify that in terms of there being a technical bear market, because frankly, we do see a tremendous amount of repair in the charts even as we speak. And you know, you could actually argue that things have not been this oversold or this attractive in the 12-year period that we've been in a bull market.
Even looking at just the charts.
Yeah, just looking at the charts, daily, weekly, or monthly charts, actually it's quite constructive. Now, the break that we saw below 1530, that obviously was not constructive, and that's what I mean. Technically, you had a sell signal at that 1530 level. We've already found our feet. We're on 1320, 1330, and we have a rebuilding of price in the mid-1400s. You're going to have series of battles to regain territory, quote-unquote, as the price of gold moves higher.
So it's not without a fight that gold will go up.
It's not without a fight, yeah. But 1485, 1530, back to 1600, and then back to 1780 or 1800. I mean, these are all areas where you can expect to see not only some resistance, but even short-term sell-offs. But we are going to regain this territory, and I think we're going to regain it fairly quickly. Because again, what you're dealing with is a banking system that is struggling to recoup. You're dealing with a fiscal system that is struggling to stay alive. You're dealing with a monetary system that for the time being, people still have confidence in, and this is where things can surprise very dramatically, very quickly. When you're dealing with a monetary system that's already being challenged, like it was in the late 60s and early 70s, you can see a trickle become a flood in terms of people wanting to get out of paper and into real things. Sophisticated investors all over the world who are basically saying, listen, I'd rather have real things. Give me farmland. Give me a chalet. Give me fine art. Give me an extra case of Chateau Lafite from 1982.
Just don't give me a bank account in Cyprus.
Don't give me a bank account in Cyprus. And in fact, what we've learned from Cyprus is the fact that we might not want any significant bank accounts anywhere in the world because we realize that depositors have been and will be abused. So the question is, where do you go to opt out of the system? Where do you go to opt out of the banking system? There is only one place that allows you to be portable, to be private, to be completely controlled, and again, out for a time being, re-engaged at some point in the future, as and when things become more interesting and more stable.
And for the clients, Dave, that don't drink wine, and we do have clients that don't really care much for wine, what you're saying actually is the one place is gold, not necessarily Chateau Lafite.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, precious metals continue to play a vital role in a portfolio. And to realize that the fundamentals have never been more supportive, I think is absolutely, absolutely imperative. The rest of the world is getting it. Not only are they getting it intellectually, but they're getting it physically. They're taking delivery off the exchanges. We've never seen this kind of traffic come off of the London Metals Exchange, come out of COMEX, come from Scotia Macata, come out of JP Morgan's stock of precious metals. I mean, we are seeing a turning of the tide in favor of the person who owns physical metals. And this is the period in time that for all the reasons that you've owned it in the past, as an insurance policy, you certainly want to continue to own it today.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.